cliffcentral.com.
Richard, are we on track with the financial pack for my presentation to the board next week?
Well, hopefully. The team's very short-staffed, and it's taking such a long time to find a suitable financial manager for the division. We're way behind on all our forecasts and reporting.
Why don't you speak to the finance team? They're a consultancy that can help you with an experienced interim financial manager. You can have somebody to help you almost immediately. They'll hit the ground running with no long-term contracts and no upfront placement fees.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to the business section of our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio today is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen.
Welcome, Safia.
Nice to have you with us. Also staying on from our previous segment is Kerry Boucher from Think Sustainability. Thank you, Kerry. Thanks for staying with us.
Pleasure,
we really
Richard.
Appreciate that. Last week, we spoke to Zandile Nzalu, founder and CEO of Zanenza, and that was a really insightful and interesting conversation. So if you haven't had an opportunity to listen to our podcast on that, please go to our website and download that. That was a really insightful conversation with what she's been able to achieve. A remarkable lady.
Dynamite comes in small packages.
Dynamite definitely does come in small packages. So that's a good one. Joining us today via a telecon is John Campbell. He's a disruptive innovator working in the world of fintech. He's on the line with us from Cape Town. We're just going to see if we can get him on the line. John, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. So, John, as an introduction to you, I know you have extensive experience in the world of fintech. I know you were extensively involved in SnapScan and a number of other really innovative developments in the fintech space. So do you want to just give us a very short synopsis about yourself, where you've been, and some background just for 2 or 3 minutes, just so that we can set the scene for our conversation for our listeners?
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Yeah, look, I think the easiest way to sum that up is where I've been always, not always in fintech, but in doing things differently and in what is commonly known as innovation. And it's really driven by having this ability to look at the world and see where things can be done better or should be done better, and then trying to find ways of doing that and making a real difference in real people's lives. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of makes me get up in the morning.
Okay, that's good. That's something that can be admired. Now, John, just for the benefit of the listeners, I mean, the word fintech gets thrown around. It's probably the new buzzword that people have. And, you know, I like to always try and, let's call it, define some elements in the show. So what is fintech, and what defines it or describes fintech? Can you help us out with that descriptor?
Okay, so let me try and make it simple. In that, so banks are regulated organizations, and they always have been, and therefore, you know, I think sometimes when people find a frustrating experience with banks, it's not because the banks want to be horrible, it's just because there's regulation that is aimed at protecting, you know, your general population. And the government, through the Reserve Bank, manages that relationship. So what has happened, though, is we're living in a fast-moving world, a very connected world, where social and the social connectedness through the type of apps everybody knows, the Facebooks, the Googles, that of the world, has kind of made the world operate a bit differently, and banks have not always responded fast enough or at the same pace, let's put it like that. And what you've now had globally is you've had clever people come up with solutions and products that address financial services needs that typically were done by banks, and also in this new electronic format. But these are not banks. They are non-bank organizations, and that's typically what you call the fintech. Now, some of them can launch on their own, but mostly they would launch a product in partnership with a bank. And I think one of the early fintechs would be something like PayPal. I mean, PayPal was a very different way, an easier way of paying for goods online. You can classify that as one of the early fintechs. And nowadays you have a lot of fintechs that that provide solutions around better ways to insure, better ways to pay from person to person, those kinds of things. Better ways to manage your card, ways to manage what they call personal finance management, being able to see where you spend. That's the kind of typical fintech players.
Now, I mean, when we talk of fintech, I mean, I having some exposure in the industry, the one thing that always strikes me is you have a lot of really innovative thinkers out there coming up with different ideas, and you know, everything gets kind of lumped into different categories in life, I guess, and fintech seems to be used to label, let me call them, different delivery models other than the traditional bricks and mortar. It seems to be we've moved to the world's world of, you know, the bricks and mortar versus the clicks, as the definition in many people's mind. I mean, how does fintech shift the world from like the traditional models, and is there any place for the traditional model alongside fintech as let's call it a method of doing business, or are these worlds almost mutually exclusive?
That's a very, very critical question that you're asking there. So if you look at the bricks and mortar businesses, a lot of the strength and the ability to compete of a traditional bricks and mortar business is based on locality.
Mm-hmm.
So where you are physically located, how many branches or outlets you have countrywide, are they in the best places, etc. Those are some of the ingredients that make for a successful traditional business. When you think of it from a digital perspective, those rules don't apply.
Hmm.
And hence you have this factor that we call the winner takes all. And that winner takes all factor really puts a spanner in the works from a disruptive perspective, and also from what we call a cannibalization perspective. So, for instance, if there are four competitors who are operating jointly or four competitors in a particular industry, they will have their competitive advantage pretty much predicated by where they can manage to put branches, can they get into the best shopping malls, etc. When you go digital, you don't need four players. If I want to buy a shoe, a particular brand of shoe online, why do I need to go and check with different ones? There's always the winner.
Mm.
So if you look at Facebook, Google, Uber, PayPal, there's only one. Mm. And everything else, those who are offering a similar service, they're like very, very far down the line, second, third run. And they almost don't feature.
Mm.
So even if you look at search, where Google is just so dominant, despite the huge amounts of money that the likes of Microsoft, et cetera, have put into trying to compete in the search space, they've just been unable to break that very, very strong dominance.
Mm.
And that's your big challenge and your disruption that digital brings. Your strength that you have, having the most branches or the biggest branches or in the best places, don't matter when the world moves digital. And I think it's fair to say that there is a big element of business, which is what you can call the sort of schlep type businesses, where, you know, you're not excited to wake up in the morning and go to banking.
Mm.
They will progressively more and more move digital.
John, just for the record, in studio you have three ex-bankers sitting around the microphones, so we all concur with you on that,
yes,
on that one.
Mm.
So, John, I mean, I think, and I want to just explore some of the stuff that you've just shared with us, because, you know, your concept of the winner takes all, and I mean, we were talking earlier, Kerry Boucher is with us in studio at the moment, we were talking about expansion in your business and how you go about right-sizing your business. And I think the one thing that always strikes me is once you've got or you find that winning recipe in the space, particularly in this type of space, the barriers to scaling are not there like they would historically have been. I mean, historically, let's use an example. You know, if you were doing, I'm going to pick one that Kerry's going to look at me and laugh at. If you were doing a beauty salon, you had to have a location and you had to have traffic and you had to have footfall. If you now are doing online nails and, cosmetics, et cetera, that you're going to just literally package and deliver to people's home, well, basically, your global store is you know, literally you can deliver to any client as long as they have a delivery address anywhere in the world, basically, and as long as obviously the economics work. But I mean, fundamentally, you're having to have a store in a location close to your customer now just becomes an irrelevant conversation from a business sizing perspective. So you're able to expand significantly, and I think for me that's one of the key things that this allows you. Hence, I guess why you say the winner takes all type of thing. There doesn't seem to be those physical boundaries of the past no longer constrain your business elements. But there must still be some boundaries to how fast this can grow and how big things can get in this space.
Yeah, if you talk about fintech specifically, your big boundaries are still things like regulatory.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, habits. So you'll find that the adoption in that space is more the next generation, your millennials, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You still have a concentration of people who like to do things in a certain way, and they trust being a big factor there. So if you look at banks, they still have a very strong hold in the trust space, especially for people, let's say 25, 30 over. They understand that if the money is safe, the banks have that space. What we don't know is, what does it mean for the next generation? Do they see that, or will they have more, would they put their trust in Facebook saying, we're good for it, or your money is safe? We don't quite know that.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that strikes me about the whole world of fintech and the whole question of, bricks and mortar is just the added, and I don't know if you say it's the same issue or the side issue of mobility. I've definitely seen mobility scale up considerably in my own business ventures. I mean, we track, and one of my businesses in the finance team, we track how people interact with us or hear of us and search, etc., and interact with us. And the instances of mobile interaction with our websites, etc., has gone to the point now where we have more people interacting with us from a mobile presence perspective than from a desktop, for example, when they're searching and interacting, which tells me that the world of mobility has really accelerated in its usage. And something recently happened. My wife was running some virus software on her computer, doing a full, one of these full in-depth scans for ransomware and all this good stuff after the incident about a week ago. And she said to me, she found 3 emails that had potential problems and was busy sorting this out. And she then made the comment to me, she said, thank goodness I haven't used my computer in a month. And I was like, okay, you haven't used your computer in a month. So how have you been working? And she runs her own business. So she said to me, but I don't use my computer ever. I do everything on my iPad and on my phone.
I don't even use my iPad.
You don't even use your iPad. You just go straight to your phone.
Yep.
And I think for me, if you had said to me even 5 years ago that you had to be able to work on your phone, and I must personally admit to this, I probably send more email from my phone than I do from my computer. It just tells you where the world is moving. And that must have a serious impact on how fintech is moving. So I would imagine that mobility is probably one of the biggest challenges and opportunities in the fintech space.
Yeah, so you're talking about 2 things there, and you're spot on. And it's interesting, there's a network effect, like what came first. Now that people can work more mobile, do they work more mobile? Or, that the tools that allow people to work mobile come as a result of people wanting to work mobile. But there's a phrase that I use. It's called life-enabling apps. And Uber is probably the prime example of that. So nobody uses the Uber app because it's cool. Nobody uses it. Like if they launch an update, you don't say, let's go for a ride around the block because you want to test a new app. You can't be bothered.
That's a good one, John. Yeah. that's a good reminder. Yeah, nobody goes for a ride to update the app. Yeah.
Yeah. So the key thing that you want to do is something like that. You're going to meet somebody that you're excited to see. You want to go to a place that you're excited to see, etc. And Uber is just such a perfect example of an app that supports you living your life. And I also have I've asked this question many times. I don't know if anybody who actually phones a competitive taxi company to get a competitive quote. So convenience wins always over price or anything else. So convenience and then just how it enables life, that's what wins. And I think that's kind of one of the things we need to look for and say, from a fintech perspective, how does that then affect the financial services in it? And there's also a good example of a winner takes all. Doesn't matter who you bank with. You don't care who Uber banks with. You put your credit card in there and you enable life. You're not worried about it. There's no loyalty there. It's not saying, I'm not going to use Uber if I don't bank with the same bank I'm with, etc. You get what I'm saying? That's where that's the first thing you're saying, life enabling. And that's where a lot of the fintechs are climbing in. They're not trying to build banking products that compete with the bank. They're building products that enable your life. And the banking part of it is just kind of plugged in there in some way or another. And that's exactly where this hashtag that we've seen called, you know, unbank, hashtag unbank. We've been complaining about that there's so many people who are unbanked, but actually there are too many people who are banked that don't need to be banked. They just want, you know, to provide something that enables what they do.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the first thing. And I think what's happened is people have seen now the ability that you can get your email on the fly anytime. You can have conference calls. I mean, I'm not sitting in an office where I'm phoning you from right now. Those types of things. And so life becomes more important. You want to live your life. And previously you couldn't because you were constrained by physicality where you had to be in an office or go to the bank or go and do this. Now that you don't have that, you can work like this.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, banking was possibly the one place where we started to see this kind of kick off with things like internet banking and electronic banking and the likes. But I think that world has moved. I mean, nowadays, your selection of where you'll go and what you'll do is actually defined by things like data coverage, Wi-Fi coverage, etc. I mean, I know when I travel for business, for example, I will specifically make sure that, you know, there's Wi-Fi connection, etc. in foreign destinations, so that I can do what I need to do. And more importantly, when I'm traveling for personal, I will go out of my way to find a place where there's no Wi-Fi, no data, and in fact, if there's no self signal, I'm even better off. So I think it does start defining our lives.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs has been reorganized.
Yeah, data access is now on the, you know, along with food and shelter, data access now appears on the bottom of the Maslow hierarchy, it would appear. But having said that, I think the one thing that strikes me as almost meaningful is we've moved to a point where we use technology all the time. It's part of our lives. But when have we taken fintech too far? Is there a point at the, you know, where it's kind of we're doing too much connected? You know, we're constantly connected with everything, everybody, all the time. Is that a bad thing potentially?
So, I mean, that's not, to me, that's not a fintech issue. That's just, I mean, there's a whole issue about are we too connected and attached to our phones and can't take a break. And, you know, we've read some of these articles about people feeling it's like an addiction. But I think the fintech part of it to me is interesting. One of the things that I've realized in the last few years is as the technology becomes far more powerful and complex, it actually allows you to build solutions and systems that are simpler. And that appeal to a broader base. And I'll give you an example of that. So we recently did a hackathon around this. So because remember, ultimately, finance or banking really just needs to enable things in your life. And you want to do that as simple and as easy as you can. And whatever technology is going to allow that, that's how far we'll push it. But this particular hackathon we did was we were using these Amazon Echo devices. So we were talking earlier about, you know, that you use a smartphone and you can do everything on there. But we know that the next I mean, if you think of what Elon Musk is trying to do by connecting the world directly to your brain, if we just go a little bit back from that, what do we do most of the time still as humans is we speak, so we use voice. So we use these Amazon Echoes and connected them into banking. Hmm. And you would think that the use case for this was like, you know, sort of technocrats or very techie type people, and it actually isn't. We found that the use case worked very well for sort of like older people, pensioners who have minimal banking that they need to do, and they can't remember passwords, they don't want to hassle with apps and stuff, and also people who've been excluded from banking and they have lots of questions to ask but they're too embarrassed to ask this question. Those are the two big use cases that came out of this exercise. So, I mean, here's a scenario. So you have aging parents retired somewhere, and now you worry about them, and you know they've got expenses to pay, and they've also still got financial affairs they want to manage. You have an Amazon Echo or an Alexa, as we call it down there, with them, and they could literally just in plain English converse with this Alexa and say, you know, please let me do some banking, or have I paid the gardener yet, or please send Benny 50 Rand. Just plain English, and then there's a bit of an authentication, whether it's using the voice or just asking for a special word. They can actually conduct their banking the way that they actually conduct their life, which is just conversing. Mm. So there you're taking very complex technology and really using it to simplify the financial transactions that people need to make in enabling their life.
Yeah, well, I recently just spent a week in the Ivory Coast at the annual SWIFT Africa Regional Conference, and we were presenting some innovative solutions there. And one of the things that came out was this whole question of what we call functional business illiteracy. So, yes, the person might be able to read and write and converse with you, you know, perhaps in English or French or whatever dominant business language is there. But once you get past the yeses and nos and please and thank yous, we're actually into a virgin territory of, you know, I don't actually know what supply chain finance is. I don't understand what working, you know, the words when you say I do inventory finance, or, you know, I need a surety, or I need control over inventory. You know, some of these terminologies, you know, people just kind of the eyes glaze over and you go, okay, so plain simple English would actually be very, very helpful. And being able to then translate that into their dominant language, be it, you know, whichever language in Africa you're speaking. I mean, think of South Africa, you know, 11 official languages and a few others in between. Wouldn't it be nice if that heavy, hefty legal contract that, you know, somebody wants you to sign is actually in your home language that you can actually understand? And I mean, I know the whole language debate has gone backwards and forwards multiple times, but the reality is, if you want me to do business with you, and if you want me to take accountability for what I'm doing, I have to be able to do that in a language that I understand, and that's not in the primary business language that we perhaps are so accustomed to. So I do believe there's a very valid space for innovation and fintech expansion in that space. I can see very practically how that happens. Now, John, I mean, you've been involved with a number of different opportunities and things out there in business to date. If you were to kind of look across your spectrum, what do you think are some of the big challenges that we see out there? I mean, if I was to say to you, look forward the next 2 to 3 years, what are some of the things that you're thinking are going to be ripe for solutions in your mind, future think?
Okay, good question, because, you know, the one thing that I always have in the back of my mind is this Wayne Gretzky comment. I think it was him who made this comment about, like, a good hockey player plays the puck where it is, and a great hockey player plays the puck where it's going to be.
Mm.
And if I look at some of the things that people are doing in business today, they're building or trying to build solutions and products for the current world.
Mm.
And I think one of the things you mentioned now about mobility, etc., we need to look at the future world and say, is this product that I'm busy designing, or this business model that I'm busy designing, is it going to be future-proof in the sense that if the world, if there's these people who are now 17, 18 and sitting on their phones all day and can talk to each other, when they start getting into business and into, you know, becoming economically active, how are they going to operate and will my business sustain that model?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is this concept of what I said earlier, collapsing the value chain. So if you look at something like what Uber does quite well, is they collapse that entire value chain from, you know, calling an operator, to finding the best route, to finding out the price, to dispatching a taxi, to making the payment, all of that is collapsed into one click. And as a business today, not a fintech business, any business, what you always got to look at is to say, am I going to be a victim of somebody collapsing the value chain? And is my business just a component of the value chain that I can potentially just be disintermediated completely as a result of that? And then the other part of it is to say, where can I optimize the way I do my business by using those kind of services? And we see a lot of that now, which is the co-working spaces with the like outsourced financial service or outsourced accountants and legal kind of services. And that's going to give a business using those services well and properly may have a competitive edge over one who's still old-fashioned and quite heavy, you know, with sort of kind of staff internally, especially with a small startup business. Mm-hmm. So for me, those are the two big things, is like how future-proof are you, because this world is changing so fast.
Mm. Now, in the last few minutes that we have, and sure, the half hour has gone really fast, John, I mean, you must see things now that you kind of go, wow, I wish I'd known that, you know, way back, say, 5, 10, 15 years ago. What are the things that you now know that if you had known 10 or 15 years back would have saved you a lot of pain and suffering? We always have this, let me call it the pay it forward question that I always ask guests, that kind of, if you had the knowledge now that you do back then, what would have helped? Because somebody listening today is going to get an insight from you that they can apply in their business going forward that's going to help them. So your opportunity to pay it forward with a thought of something that you now know.
Yes, so if there was one thing that I would say, and it was relevant 15, 20 years ago, and I often didn't pay attention to it, and other times I was lucky, and I would say this is becoming more relevant going forward, is understand your customer deeply. So there's a sort of a new movement, I don't know what to call it, a new movement or a mechanism called design thinking. And design thinking is a way of designing new businesses or new products, etc. And what it does is it has a very unemotional, or, you know, you decouple the emotions and preconceived ideas when speaking to customers and designing your future products. And it is the most amazing process, like even for somebody like me who's designed lots of businesses and products over the years, when you actually get involved with the customer at that level and you realize how off the mark we can be with the things that we build. And I've seen too many people sadly build businesses and products and put their life savings and all the energy and everything into it, and it fails because they just didn't listen to the customer or didn't understand what they were trying to solve. I've personally done it. I've lost money in a business where I missed a very, very small thing, and it was just about a habit that people have, and to break those habits are very difficult. And if you don't factor that into your design, it won't work. And it doesn't matter what people tell you. So to go and say to somebody, I'm thinking of building this, what do you think? And they'll say, oh, this is a cool idea. But the truth is they'll never use it. And then you wonder, now, why not? Everybody, all my friends told me this was a cool idea. Why is nobody using it? Because you missed something critical. And I think it's becoming far more important, and it's far more scientific what those little things are, because people have a lot of opportunities and products and competitors vying for their attention and their time.
John, I think that is such an insightful comment. I think that's something that we could all learn from, is having that deep knowledge and understanding of one's customer. Wow, that's really... And coming from somebody in the fintech space just tells you that the basics of a business transcend all else, and fundamentally that relationship with your customer no matter what the delivery mechanism, no matter what the type of business, no matter what the nature of your business and the location of your business, the fundamental elements or the fundamental element of customer importance is critical. John, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate your time with us. Thank you to Kerry for staying on and joining us.
Thank you, Steph,
for being with us. Next up, the Youth Leadership Platform. CliffCentral.com.